I'm speaking with Marley Molloy and Charles Bowden, co-editors of the new book El Sicario, Autobiography of a Mexican Assassin. Marley Molloy is professor and librarian at New Mexico State University. Since 2008, she has been documenting killings in Ciudad Juarez via her Frontera list by reporting statistics taken from local newspaper reports. In 2010 alone, she documented more than 3,000 murders in Ciudad Juarez. And Charles Bowden is a journalist and author of more than 20 books. His most recent book, just out in paperback, is Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marley Molloy and Charles Bowden.
Happy to be here.
And obviously it's a little grim here on Cinco de Mayo to be talking about a Mexican hitman, but you've really, through this man, I think you've provided us with a real window into the dysfunction of the war on drugs and the very relationship that this assassin had. I mean, the bottom line is he was a contract killer, but he was also a commandante in the Chihuahuan State Police. He was also trained by the U.S., by the FBI, and he was right inside the system, both as, I guess, as the arsonist and the fire brigade.
That's correct.
What's the resonance here in the United States so far? Are we just so deeply in denial that here we are, the destination for the drugs, the demand side that's providing all the money, that's fueling all of this stuff? I guess our attitude is kind of like the piano player in the whorehouse, right?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't be that harsh on piano players. But what we're doing, we're blaming drug addicts for violence in our country and violence in Mexico. And I think that response is, one, illogical, two, gutless, and three, despicable. We've created a huge market that's illegal by the prohibition against drugs. And in the last, good God, 4.5 years, it's killed 40,000 Mexicans. And that's what we should answer and address. The Sicario is a normal product of this system. He's a man who decided to make a living killing people, and the state endorsed him. And so, in a sense, did the U.S. These people are not accidents. They're the products of these policies.
So, Molly, explain, though, what Charles just said about the state endorsing him. The extent to which this fellow was already on the cartel's payrolls before he entered the police academy. In fact, he was put into the police academy, I assume, by the cartels, and he was one of 50 in his class out of 200 that were on the cartel payroll.
That's right. The way he describes it, as a young boy, really, I think he was probably in the range of 14 or 15 years old when he started, and he was recruited by cartel people in Juarez at that time to drive cars across the international bridge. At that time, this would have probably been in the mid-1980s. There was a lot less enforcement on the bridge than there is now, a lot less searching of vehicles and stuff. And so one way to get drugs across the border was to load up a car by stuffing drugs in the gas tank and in other secret compartments in the car and things like that, and just having unsuspecting-looking people drive them across the bridge, park the cars, and then walk back to Juarez. And he was initially paid, I believe, about $50 a load, which for a poor kid from a barrio in Juarez was a heck of a lot of money. As he kept doing it and kept getting, you know, more accomplished at it, he would get paid a little more. Also, as the security got a little better, it became more dangerous. And so I think what the cartel was doing was, in a sense, protecting some of the people who were higher up by getting these kids to do this, you know, most dangerous aspect of the smuggling. Because if the kids got caught, all that would really happen would be that, you know, that load of drugs would be lost. No one important would be under arrest or anything. And so that was sort of how he got into doing it. Later on, he was in some trouble with his college. He was actually a college student at the time in his first year at the university in Mexico and in Juarez. He got into trouble with some members of his family, and his way of solving the problem was to go and join the police academy. And he, at the time he suggested it, or at the time the trouble came up, he already knew he could get in because the people that he was working for, cartel people, were the very people who would get him into the academy. And then, as he described it, a fairly large contingent of every class of cadets was on the payroll of the cartel, and so they would actually use the training academies of the state police to groom their future operatives. And that's how he got into both being a state policeman and a fairly high-level hitman or sicario for the Juarez cartel.
And Charles Bowden, even though he may not be the perfect example of Los Ninis, but can you explain to our audience Mexico's probably its most egregious social problem are these young people who neither study nor work?
Well, yeah, he is a product of that. I mean, this guy is really bright. Molly and I both know him. If he had been born in El Paso instead of Juarez, I have no doubt he'd have become a professional person. He wanted to become an architect. Here's the problem. In Juarez, 50% of the adolescents are neither in school nor have jobs. And Juarez is not just some backwater. Juarez is literally the poster child for our foreign policy trade agreement, NAFTA, the free trade agreement. The earliest implementation of this policy started in Juarez in the 1960s. And what it's produced is a city not only of death, but a city that can't educate its young or give them a job. And, of course, then people ask me sometimes when I give talks, why is it violent? Well, why don't you go have a cup of coffee and figure it out? People have no future.
Well, let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Molly Malloy and Charles Bowden, co-editors of the new book, El Sicario, Autobiography of a Mexican Assassin. El Sicario, roughly translated as Hitman, and this is a vitally important discussion here on Cinco de Mayo to really hone in on the central problem that Mexico faces in its rather tortured relationship with its northern neighbor in this hideous embrace of drugs and denial that's caused the death of over 15,000 people in Mexico just in this one year. Molly, you have obviously spent a lot of time looking into the disappearance of hundreds of women in Ciudad Juarez. There's a connection with El Sicario, isn't there? He's obviously provided you with some intelligence about what's behind all that.
Well, he mentions in his in the interviews that we did with him, which were essentially monologues. He basically wanted this story told, and he told us the story without being asked very many questions at all. He mentions women. What happened with the women in Juarez, starting in around the early to mid-1990s, there was an increase in the number of very young women who disappeared, and many of them were found murdered. One of the things that's important to know, though, and the Sicario also talks about the fact that he sometimes procured women for fiestas. He would, if one of the bosses that he worked for wanted or had a desire to be with a particular woman, he would make an offer to this woman, and if she agreed to the terms, then she could go off and have a weekend or something with one of these bosses. The terms, of course, were that, you know, she would basically have to shut up about it, never mention it again. Some of the women in his story, the way that he tells the story, is that some women wanted more than this kind of liaison. They actually wanted to marry or become, together with one of these capos in a more permanent way. And if they demanded too much or if they didn't keep their mouth shut about the arrangement, then they could very easily be disappeared. I don't think that the majority of the women who've been killed in Juarez over the past 15 to 20 years were victims of this kind of activity. I think certainly some of them were, and I wouldn't even venture a guess as to what percentage. The facts are most of the women who were murdered and disappeared in Juarez all during the 1990s and into the 2000s were victims of domestic violence, partner murder. They were usually murdered by someone they knew. the thing that's been going on in the last few years, beginning in 2008 when the murders just exploded in Juarez, is that many more women have been killed. But as a percentage of the total number of people killed, it's actually much less, meaning that the main relationship between the women killed in Juarez and the murders of women in Juarez is that the more men killed, the more women killed. It's just it's almost a steady ratio of 10%. So for every 10 men disappeared and killed in Juarez, there are there's one woman, and this ratio holds constant over many, many years. Also, in the last few years, since the explosion of violence began in 2008, most of the women killed are killed in the same circumstances as the men. They're not disappeared. They're not found buried in the desert, but rather they're shot point blank on the street or in their home or in their cars in the very same way that the executions of men are happening. So the phenomena of the murders of women in Juarez is something that I think has really been misunderstood and misrepresented in the press, both in Mexico nationally and internationally.
And Charles Bowden, El Sicario, when he was in the police academy, he was getting 150 pesos a month from the government, the Mexican government, and getting $1,000 from the cartels at the same time. And then, of course, he was also sent to be trained at the FBI training center in Tucson, Arizona. And the fact that he was one of 50 cartel plants, if you will, inside the police academy, in a quarter of the class of 200, if you extend that ratio out to the entire country of Mexico, since he was a state policeman, I mean, would that be a ballpark figure of how thoroughly compromised law enforcement is in Mexico?
Well, it would be ballpark, but frankly, everybody's not worth owning. That if you were running a drug organization, for example, and you wanted to buy U.S. Customs people at the port of entry, you wouldn't waste your money to buy everybody that worked there. You just get a couple so you could get things done that you needed done. So, but your point, as I take it, is correct. The drug organizations, the drug industry in Mexico has penetrated all law enforcement. And this isn't anything new. This has been going on for years. They have a working relationship. They're interchangeable. The way to misunderstand the Sicario in the book is to see him as a rogue cop or a cop that went bad. He is neither. He was employed by the state, employed by the drug organization, and everybody knew it. That's how it operates. He is, in a sense, the face of the Mexican government. One other thing that your listeners should know is when he got that $1,000 a month, or $1,500, I've forgotten what it is, from a bank, it didn't fall from heaven. It came from a bank in the U.S. The banks in the U.S. are full of drug money, and everybody knows it. 1995, the El Paso banks were running, I think, $70 million a month or so over any licit explanation that the licit economy of El Paso could possibly explain. And trust me, it's not less now, it's more.
Just with a wave of a hand, a U.S. custom official can make 50 grand. Is that's the going price, right?
Where well, just I waves don't know. I haven't taken a bribe lately. But the fact is, anybody that's crossed the bridge in a car has been waved through almost always. And so what you're asking somebody to do if the vehicle's full of drugs is to just wave their hand one more time. People become susceptible then. And so, yes, there is no question in my mind that if you check indictments, which are just a little percentage of what's going on, that the corruption on the U.S. border with Mexico is increasing as the money increases. The same thing's happening in the Border Patrol. As the cost of being a migrant goes up, meaning instead of paying $500, say now you're paying $3,000 to get through, the amount of money in the pool to bribe a Border Patrol agent increases. There's no question about that either.
So what kind of internal affairs operation does Customs and Border Patrol have? Or are they a part of this whole kind of cultural denial on this side of the border where somehow we're not responsible, even though we're the market for the drugs and this is where all the money that's generated to buy the guns that kill the people and to corrupt the system comes from? So
well, Like, they have internal investigations, internal affairs, but I think they're half-hearted. I also think what I'd like your listeners to understand is that the people that go into Customs and the Border Patrol are decent people, want to be in law enforcement. Then they get in a circumstance where some of them decides it's hopeless, and then they start taking money. And oddly, in a way, we created a circumstance that corrupts decent people. I'm sure, surely your listeners know that in the 40 years of the war on drugs this country's waged, every drug's more available now, every drug's of higher quality now, every drug's cheaper now in real dollars. Well, if you're one of these agencies, you know, some people just throw up their hands, like, why are we doing this? Somebody offers them essentially a lot of money just to wink while something goes by, and they take it. That's what happens.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Bowden, journalist and author for more than 20 books. His most recent book out recently in paperback is Murder City, Sweet That Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. And he is the co-author, along with Molly Malloy, of this new book, or co-editor of this new book, El Sicario, Autobiography of a Mexican Assassin. Molly, obviously you can't say anything about his whereabouts, but all that we know, we're told, is that he's somewhere here in the United States and he has a protector. But he must have a lot of embarrassing information.
Well, I think he does. I think he knows a lot about the leadership of the Juarez cartel, especially, because that's the organization that he was mostly involved with. One of the things that he reveals in his story is that at the around the time that he planned and executed his escape from the cartel and escape from Juarez, things were really changing around him, almost breaking down. At one point, he tells us that he was not even sure who he was working for at some point. He would get an order to carry out an execution, but he didn't know for certain which cartel leader he was actually doing the execution for. And this breakdown started happening probably around the middle of 2007, we think. And then, you know, part of that is what led to the really huge explosion of violence that began in Juarez in 2008. This battle between, and most people think, between the Sinaloa cartel and the Juarez cartel for the control of the passage through Juarez. One of the other things that he says is very interesting, though, is that he says the violence has acted more as a smokescreen than anything else, meaning that the shipments of drugs are continuing. The shipment of the product from different places in the interior of Mexico to Juarez, and then from Juarez crossing over into the United States to be sold on the streets of many U.S. cities, that the money from that, from those drugs is flowing just as well as it ever has. And so whatever this battle is between different cartel bosses to control Juarez that has cost the lives of more than 8,500 people just in the city of Juarez over the past 4 years, that it hasn't done anything to impede the flow of drugs. And so I agree with what Chuck says, is that the system fuels this economic, or the drugs are the fuel for this huge economic engine. Most of the money comes from the United States. Most of the drugs come from Mexico. And Mexico could not do without the money that is infused into their economy from this illegal and terribly violent business. And the Sicario actually said, using, you know, the Spanish word for smokescreen, that the violence is, everyone is paying attention to the violence, and no one is seeming to notice that the drugs keep flowing. And his intelligence on that score comes from knowledge he has of where drugs are stored in Juarez and in other places in the state of Chihuahua, and how those drugs are moved around within the city. And he knows a lot about it. And, yeah, I think it would be very valuable intelligence if the drug enforcement people from our country were really interested in stopping it.
But are they interested? I mean, they must have talked to him, surely. He's been debriefed by the DEA, I imagine, hasn't he?
As far as I know, that has never occurred. No, sir.
Yeah, I'll take a bite of that apple. I have connections in DEA. I wrote a book about a murder of the brother of the head of DEA intelligence. I placed calls. They didn't want to touch him with a 10-foot pole.
Why?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because their check comes every Friday if they sit on their ass or didn't do nothing. There's a saying in DEA, big cases, big problems. Little cases, little problems. No cases, no problems. We're the third choice. Mm. Well, I was flabbergasted because I can't tell you what he knows, but trust me, he knows a lot, not just of where things are stored in Mexico. He told Molly and I both that when he was working in the organization, they had connections in DEA and the FBI. That's why they weren't afraid of them. And he's not the only person in his business that's told me that.
So there's the real untold story, surely, Charles Bowden, that here we in the United States, we've been corrupted too. We sort of take a kind of vicarious pleasure, if you will, out of that we're not like Mexico, but that's clearly not the case, right?
Well, look, we are being corrupted. That's true. I'm an American, and I love my fellow citizens, but most of them are not saints. But here's the deal. The Mexican economy is 4% the size of the U.S. The $30 to $50 billion in hard currency the Mexican drug industry brings into Mexico every year has enormous power in that society. That's more than they make from any licit export. The drug industry is even larger in the U.S., but our economy is so gigantic that it doesn't have nearly the influence here. And so in that sense, the corruption is less, meaning it doesn't reach into the cabinet of a president here. It does in Mexico, and everybody knows it, drunk or sober.
Molly, in terms of El Sicario being a state policeman and a cartel employee at the same time, and along with one quarter of the police force, seconded into the drug business even before he went into the police academy, he's not a member of the Zetas, is he?
No. I'm pretty confident in saying no. He talked about the Zetas when he mentions that in the story. I think that he probably, at some point during his training, he had training for people, from people who later on became Zetas or who had the same kind of training that the Zetas did, that is, military training. He mentions that during his time in the police academy, they would have trainers that would come from the military and things like that. He is very respectful of the caliber of training that the Zetas have received and the way that they operate. At this point in his life, he thinks that they are evil, but he has extraordinary respect for their power to kill people. He says at one point, the saying is, it takes a Zeta to kill a Zeta, because they are all trained to be so powerful in terms of how they execute their crimes.
And they are the embodiment of the corruption of the Mexican military then. I mean, wasn't that the greatest concern about bringing the military in to fight the war on drugs, that it would inevitably be corrupted? It sounds like it's happened in the worst possible way.
Well, absolutely. And I don't think it's not exactly correct that say they would inevitably be corrupted. They've always been corrupted to a certain degree. Although I believe that up until maybe the last 10 or 15 years or so, the Mexican army had more respect than some of the other law enforcement agencies in the country of Mexico. They were seen as basically a defense force for the country, and also the kind of force that did really good works during natural disasters. And as you know, Mexico is plagued with earthquakes, hurricanes, and other kinds of natural disasters. The army always shows up for those things. In fact, a Mexican army contingent went to New Orleans during the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and helped to do some relief work there. So the Mexican army has been and still is to a certain degree known for these kinds of works. At the same time, they have been trained by generals, by the same kinds of training that have occurred with Latin American militaries and Central American militaries for at least the past 50 years or more in this hemisphere. It's a very elitist force at the higher levels. Once a person becomes an officer and moves up the ranks, they see themselves as quite separate from the rest of Mexican society. And I think they see themselves as somewhat omnipotent. They see themselves as people who can get away with pretty much whatever they want. And sadly, this kind of brutal power has now been unleashed in many cities and towns and territories in Mexico. And it's not you can't get it back under control by sending in the police, because these are men with guns. They wield a lot of power. They control a lot of territory. And within that territory, they, you know, operate with complete impunity. Mexican military members are almost never punished for any crime, even when it is proven by the Human Rights Commission of Mexico that they've committed these crimes. The cases are essentially just disappeared, and no punishment is ever meted out to these military people who commit such crimes against their own people.
Clearly, the Zetas, they've been implicated in some of these hideous murders of Central American migrants just south of the border. And El Sicario also talks about some of the most unbelievably depraved forms of torture that they mete out on each other, boiling people alive. It's just mind-boggling. But Charles, let me ask you, though, about the broader picture here, because I've spoken to some specialists on Mexico in think tanks, etc. They're suggesting that what's going on with this failed war on drugs that has the president of Mexico now on the defensive, and many people inside the Mexican establishment saying that we've got to change our tactics and even consider some forms of legalization. We know that the PRI party is growing in popularity, and they were the ones that were involved with the drug cartels in a total complicity for so many decades. The idea that they could be elected back into power by an exhausted electorate is pretty dismal. But my understanding that what tactically is going on here is that essentially they're letting Guzman El Chapo take over and kill everybody else off, and then they'll just have one cartel to deal with. Is there anything to that?
I have no idea. That's what I hear, but the people that tell me that have never spoken to a cartel member since they've walked the earth in the think tanks. So I disregard that.
Sure.
The second thing is, anybody that talks about a war on drugs in Mexico is obviously a liar. Since this alleged war started, January 1st, 2007, 40,000 to 50,000 Mexicans have been slaughtered. The Army, by President Calderon's own statement, this March of this year, has lost less than 300 people. What in the hell what kind of war is this? The cartel is fighting with beanbags or something? This is preposterous. It's a war for drugs, for the money. Nobody could attack these organizations like the Zetas and only lose less than 300 soldiers in 4.5 years. But what we're facing is a country that's dependent on drugs, where the state's faltering and the new infrastructure are criminal organizations that are dispersed. There is no center to this thing anymore. And we want to attack it with a $500 million budget to the Mexican Army, which is in the drug business anyway. If this makes sense to you, you must be on drugs.
Well, I'm afraid we have to end on this note. And once more,
I like to leave you with happy thoughts.
Well, I'm just saying, whenever I did talk about this story and the dysfunctional war on drugs, you end up with absolute despair. It really is the old adage of Einstein's, where if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, that's a definition of insanity.
Well, that's true, but I'd like to leave you with two thoughts. One, the book's a creation of Molly. She did the translations, constant follow-up interviews, put it together. Two, the book's unique. I don't know of any other book where a person like this has ever spoken out at this length. What I'm telling your listeners is this is a unique opportunity to get a window into the Mexican soul and into the drug world without the think tanks, without Homeland Security, without all these smoke screens in our country. The door is opened, and all you have to do is walk through it to learn.
And the way to do that is to get hold of this brand new book, El Sicario, Autobiography of a Mexican Assassin by Molly Malloy, our guest here today, and Charles Bowden. I thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Molly. Again, I've been speaking with Molly Malloy and Charles Bowden, co-editors of the new book, El Sicario, Autobiography of a Mexican Assassin.